Hello, Restless History Club members. Hope you had a wonderful Christmas. And for this week's bonus episode, Dominic, what have we got lined up?
Well, what we thought we would do is we would give you the chance to hear the live show that we did in October when we went to the Odeon Leicester Square and we did our top 10 historical films.
Well, it wasn't so, top 10, was it?
Was it our top 10?
No, we did more than that. We did lots more than that.
The producers are lying to us. It wasn't our top 10.
They've kind of written this script and it's absolutely
They didn't even listen to the show. Shocking. So it wasn't our top 10. It was a sort of debased version of an Oscars ceremony.
That was the original plan. My original plan was that we'd come on in black tie and hand out awards. But Dominic refused to wear black tie.
I just thought it looked ridiculous.
You were right. So basically, it's various categories of film. So what did we have? We had political films. We had most implausible historical actor.
Yeah, we had kind of America stuff. On American history on film.
And you will not believe your eyes when you see the very first film that Dominic chose to.
Well, they won't believe their eyes because they'll be listening to it.
Well, okay, yes. Well, so that actually highlights the fact that this was obviously people sat down and they could see various extracts of films. So you won't be able to see the extracts, but you'll just have to imagine them. And what I will say is that Dominic's opening selection is the Ku Klux Klan from America.
The producers themselves have written of Tom's unbelievable final pick.
Yeah, so my
you
final
would not
pick,
believe what this is going to build up
my
to.
Final pick. Selection of historical films. Yeah, my final pick you will be able to hear because there is a musical number, but I will say no more. So I hope you enjoy that.
All right. Happy New Year. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And welcome to The Rest is History Live. In the glittering heart of London's West End. In a cinema, Dominic.
It's very exciting, isn't it? I've spent the last year locked in my front room, or indeed my back room, talking to you. So the thought of talking to you again in front of 600 people, nothing could be more exciting.
It's kind of the nightmare, isn't it? You kind of... anxiety dream that you're talking to me, but you're doing it in front of loads of people.
I know. I hear your voice in my sleep talking about Christianity, and it's just... I mean, you can imagine.
Well, we're going to... will we keep off the subject of Christianity today? I don't know. I mean, it's kind of interesting to see. We'll find out. I don't think it's going to be immediately... we do have a Christian theme coming up.
We do have
a Christian theme coming up, but not immediately, Dominic, because we should explain what we're going to do this afternoon, because here we are in a cinema, and so... the obvious thing to do is cinema and history.
It was your idea. It was Tom's idea. At first, as always with Tom's ideas, I thought it was a terrible idea. But everybody else in the Rest is History team thought it was a good idea, and it is. And actually, you know what, Tom? Cinema and history have been interwoven from the very beginning.
Don't you have some amazing facts?
I do have some
to that
good
effect.
Facts. I always
would you like to share them with the audience?
Exactly.
As you shared them with me a bit earlier on.
So the first special effect in a film dates from 1895, and it is a film about the execution of Mary Queen of Scots.
So the special effect is her head.
Is her head being so? It's a jump cut between Mary Queen of Scots, avec head, Mary Queen of Scots, sans head. That's the effect. And people were very excited, apparently, at the time. They thought it was... Some people thought, have they beheaded the actress? These were presumably the same people who thought that famous first film of the train thought that the train was really... So a story that's almost certainly untrue. But also, the very first sort of film, multi-reel film, feature film, was a film about... Do you know? Well, you do know, because I've told you.
I've actually already forgotten.
Yeah, I'm such an interesting conversationalist that Tom has already forgotten. So it was... a film about Ned Kelly. It was an Australian film, believe it or not.
But what we do know, because we've discussed this in the Western, is that the first Western was shot in the Lake District.
Yeah, I think all good films. Star Wars The Force Awakens was shot in the Lake District at Lake Coniston.
So I think basically we've demonstrated that history and film is a great subject, a legitimate subject. So what we've done is we've worked out nine categories, and each category has two films. And at one point, we were kind of thinking we should come on in black tie.
This was
entirely
Tom's idea.
So I wasn't allowed to do that.
Yeah, but a gimmick too far even for us.
But even so, this is quite challenging because it means we have to do live maths. Because we've got basically 70 minutes. We're going to have questions.
Yeah.
And we've got 9 categories. Yeah. So we have to do each...
8 minutes per...
Whatever.
Anyway, 4 minutes per
So we're going to try and do it. And we've got our lovely producers here at the back who are going to whisper in our ear if we go over.
Yeah. And they're going to show clips.
We're going to have a few clips.
So
our first category...
Yeah.
...is the idea of America and American history as something that is created by film and that... film then helps to create America's sense of its history.
Yeah, and American history creates cinema as well.
Yeah, yeah. And Dominic, you've chosen the very first one. And ladies and gentlemen, massive trigger warning. This is quite a punchy start.
yeah, I thought going hard. Going hard.
It's absolutely Dominic's. So, yeah. Jack, could we have it?
Yeah, let's have the first film, Jack.
Punchy, I think you'll agree. So, Dominic, why have you... So, Birth of a Nation, an incredibly famous film, but also a notorious film.
Yeah, an incredibly notorious film and an incredibly important film. So, if you're writing the history of cinema, this is one of the 2 or 3 films that has to be there. So, a lot of people may have seen Battleship Potemkin, Eisenstein's film, which is probably the earliest film that anyone ever watches voluntarily now. Birth of a Nation is very long. It's the first multi-reel feature film at the time, by far the most expensive and the highest grossing film ever made, 1915.
And I think it was the highest grossing until Gone with the Wind.
Yeah.
So both of them very much, because we should say this is a film about the build-up to the American Civil War, the Civil War, and then the aftermath.
Yeah, about Reconstruction. So it's a film that enshrines the idea in America that the White South was kind of betrayed, that it was invaded by sort of northern carpetbaggers. There's a reference to carpetbaggers there in the caption. And basically, the heroes of the film are the Klan. So the film is based on a book called The Klansman by Thomas Dixon, who is from a Ku Klux Klan family. His family are ex-Confederates. They've been in the Klan. The film's director, D.W. Griffith, a titanic name in the history of cinema. His father had been a Confederate veteran. And that stuff that you saw there is basically, there's a scene when somebody is terrorizing children, black children, dressed as a ghost, and that gives this officer, a heroic figure in the film, the idea of founding the Klan. And they dress up in the white robes, and they ride to Wagner's Ride of the Valkyries and so on. But the Klan hadn't really done that. They hadn't burned crosses in the 1870s. They hadn't worn white robes. But when they were relaunched in the second half of the 1910s, they do. They copy it from the film. So it's an incredibly influential film. I mean, it's arguably one of the most influential films in history because it basically recreates the Ku Klux Klan in the 1920s.
And the thing to say is that even when this was made, it was incredibly controversial. There was huge hostility to the film. Woodrow Wilson, it's the first film...
Yeah, first film shown in the White House.
And
there's this very contested quote, did Wilson or not? Did he say it or not?
He said it was kind of history lit by lightning.
Yeah, written with lightning. And it was used as an endorsement. So it's very controversial. But it's also, just purely as a film, as a cinematic achievement, it showed what cinema could do in a way that no film before that had done. So it's odd, and it's a shame for the sort of film industry's history, that really one of its absolute foundational pillars is so tainted. Because, I mean, the stuff really I think we couldn't really show to a big audience of the actors in blackface and so on.
Yeah.
And the sort of incredibly caricatured and really sort of viciously racist. I mean, it's not just quite racist.
No, it's incredibly racist.
The racism is the absolute driving motor of the film.
The thing, I hadn't watched it before, and so I I kind of skip bits, I'm not going to deny. But one of the one
it's
of
very
the
boring. I mean, that's the other thing.
Yeah,
about
it's, so it's racist and boring. But apart from that, it's great. but one of the things that did strike me was that actually it's it could equally be used to campaign against the Ku Klux Klan, because loads in it is you know, they kind of line up on their horses to stop black voters from voting.
Yeah.
They lynch somebody and dump the body. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that would, you know, you could make a film now about the Ku Klux Klan, put that kind of stuff in, and it would be.
But the way it's presented, well, I mean, all you need to know is that after the film, people did copycat lynchings. I mean, yeah, the film inspired lynchings. So people didn't watch those scenes and think, how repellent. Or rather,
but
you know,
some
black
did.
Americans,
some must
black
have
Americans
done.
Did.
Some, yeah.
The New York Times campaigned against the film. Lots of people in the North were very agitated about the film. But in the South, it was obviously an absolutely tremendous hit. And it helped to create this idea of the lost cause of the Confederacy.
Yeah, and I think that the way in which this film, you know, it's not just kind of holding up a mirror to how America, certain classes of American are seeing the past, but it's actually helping them to invent it.
Yeah, and that's why I think it's so important to start today with it, because it's a reminder of how the power, I mean, operas had had this power in the 19th century, and the novel, obviously, before that. But cinema had, and maybe has, an unparalleled power to shape people's perception of the past, don't you think? Or you think
I do. I absolutely do. And I think that this is a film that you'd have to be kind of David Duke, basically, still to say that this was a great film, that this was something kind of that could inspire you. But are we ready to have our next?
Well, you've chosen. So I chose Birth of a Nation. You chose something which is much more sort of benign, which basically is true to our personas. So why don't we have Tom's much kinder and gentler film? Tom, are you stirred? Are you roused?
I'm very stirred. So as that says, that's Young Mr. Lincoln, made in 1939 by John Ford, starring Henry Fonda. Again, it's kind of, even though this is set before the Civil War and Lincoln's presidency, still very much its focus. But I think what's interesting about this film is that very unexpectedly it turns what's basically a biopic about Lincoln into a Western. So the young Lincoln is kind of, you know, he's working in a shop. He gets a law book. He decides he wants to be a lawyer. He goes off to a town on the Wild West frontier, and he saves some men who have been unjustly accused of a murder. So he's basically like a kind of sheriff riding into town, cleaning up the bad guys and helping the good. And essentially that ending, which ends the film, you can see him striding off like a sheriff who's cleaned up the town to go and do good elsewhere. And of course, we know what the good is that he's going to do. He's going to lead.
He's going to become Daniel Day-Lewis.
He's going to go and become Daniel Day-Lewis. I think it's interesting because it shows that American history can also be portrayed in an incredibly positive way. And I think that the myth of the West has probably been the most powerful.
Yeah.
But, of course, and I think, again, this is something we'll come on to perhaps later, that also now is well, can we say problematic?
You can.
So the idea... So we've talked about the Wild West, one of the episodes on the Wild West. The idea that even, you know, even someone like Lincoln coming in and cleaning up America's problems, that's now would kind of raise eyebrows.
Well, it's also because that's pure great man history, isn't it? So there's always been a strain in America's sort of historical cinematic tradition. You know, even if you think about so many presidential films, in Oliver Stone's JFK, the idea that, you know, that's a moment that transforms America because a great man is cut off in his prime. Even the Oliver Stone Nixon film is a kind of
another great man cut off in his prime.
Absolutely. much maligned Richard Nixon. But it's a sort of the idea of the Shakespearean, you know, destiny of the president, all that kind of thing. I mean, that's absolutely... America has always had that in its cinematic tradition in a way that in Britain I don't think we have quite to the same extent. I mean, there's maybe Henry V, Olivier's Henry V, there's maybe the endless succession of Churchill biopics. But by and large, we don't go in for that, I think, as much as Americans do. They're much more unself-conscious, or have been.
But they're worried. But so Henry Fonda, who plays Lincoln in that, goes on to play the villain in Once Upon a Time in the West.
A long time later, though.
Yeah, a long time. Yes, exactly. But by the time, when's that made? 70s or something?
69.
By that point, the idea that Westerns are unapologetically about good guys and bad guys
absolutely.
Has been complicated.
Yes.
So, I mean, that's a theme of cinema, isn't it? That that tradition is going to end up with Dances with Wolves and...
Sort of Unforgiven, have you seen Unforgiven?
Unforgiven, yes.
Yeah, sort of revisionist Westerns. You couldn't do an unrevisionist Western now, could you?
I don't know.
Well, you love Westerns, don't you? You're a great Wild West man.
I quite like to see, a classic.
Yeah, a remake.
Kind of a Western where it was kind of old school.
Right.
But they'd never make it now, I guess.
No. Well, good luck pitching that to Hollywood. So I think we should go into our second category, don't you?
I do, because this is where Christianity comes in.
Yeah.
So this is ancient spectacle.
Yeah, which has also been a huge part of cinema from the 1900s and 1910s. They started to create images of sort of Babylon, of Rome, and so on. Because cinema.
Well, Griffiths did, didn't he?
Exactly.
Because he was so offended at everyone daring to criticise Birth of a Nation that he made a film called Intolerance, which featured the capture of Babylon by Cyrus the Great, the king of Persia.
A
much underdeveloped theme in cinema history, I think.
Yeah.
Shame he didn't focus on that.
Yeah. So this is about the ancient world, and why don't we have our first clip, and it's a film that many of you...
It's a clip that's so famous that we've actually already had it on the montage.
Okay, let's see it. Another slightly boring film. I've never watched Ben-Hur without falling asleep.
What?
Yeah, no. I struggle even to make it to the chariot racing. But you know, Tom, this has...
It's got everything. It's got chariot races. It's got Jesus.
It's got a lot of Christianity. but this is also... There's a nice link, before you get onto the sacral, there's a nice link with Birth of a Nation, because there's a Civil War prehistory to this too. So Lew Wallace, who wrote Ben-Hur, the novel... According to some counts, the single best-selling American novel of the 19th century, ahead of Uncle Tom's Cabin, he had been a Union general in the Civil War. And after the Civil War, he is inspired to write this book about Jesus and about the Romans. And you know what? Wait. This, the chariot race, supposedly, I bet you don't know this fact, do you know what inspired it?
No.
He apparently once had a horse race with Ulysses S. Grant.
That's brilliant.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
I didn't know that. But this is the most complex. I think the most complex. It's 4-minute sequence. It took 3 months to film. Yeah. 7,000 extras. And there's a famous story, isn't there, that an extra died, which isn't actually true.
Is that right? I didn't know.
Well,
that.
So the truth of it is that Charlton Heston's stunt double gets thrown from a chariot. And there was an earlier silent version made in 1923 or something where somebody was killed.
But not in this film.
But loads and loads of people kind of watch it, trying to see the bit where
so the
where
theme
someone
that's,
dies.
That's interesting about this, especially for you, is about Christianity versus Rome.
Yeah,
it's sort of there's a Britain and America issue, is there, with the accents? Maybe is this one of these films where the Romans?
Well, so I think those are two crucial themes, and one it's, so the plot is that Charlton Heston is Ben Hur. Grows up, a childhood friend is a Roman, Messala, who is racing in that. Messala decides to, according to Gore Vidal, because Messala has a crush on Ben-Hur and Ben-Hur has rejected him.
Yeah, Charlton Heston was livid when Gore Vidal...
So that subtext is contested. But anyway, Charlton Heston ends up becoming a galley slave. He gets rescued by Jack Hawkins, who's a Roman admiral. He comes back, he finds that his mother and his sister have become lepers because Messala's dumped them in a leper colony. Jesus is going to be crucified and he heals them of leprosy, and then it ends.
Yeah.
Owen Masala's died.
Yeah.
So everyone ends happy. But I think two themes there. One is that in these epic films, you kind of need a contemporary perspective, which for Americans when this was made is basically the Christian one. So you will always have, in all these kind of epic films, you'll have Romans and you'll have Christians. And, you know, ditto with the kind of the spectacular epics, the Cecil B. DeMille one. So we had the Ten Commandments, of which James Thurber famously said it showed what God could have done if he'd had the money, which I think is really good. But you touched on the theme of accents, which, yes, I think is really, really...
Yeah, Romans don't generally have American accents, do they?
Romans generally are British.
Yeah.
And heroes and slaves and Christians are American.
Ben-Hur was one of the first films, I think, to establish that principle, that basically Jews and sort of the downtrodden peoples of the Roman Empire will be American. And it's a way of, I suppose, dealing with their own history with empire. I mean, America has an empire by the point this film was made. And America, there's also a Cold War subtext, of course, to a lot of these 50s ancient epics. They're about freedom against tyranny, aren't they?
Well, Spartacus, which is kind of, you know, was written as you'd like this. Have you read Spartacus? It's a Marxist novel.
I mean, I haven't.
Right up your street. But in that one, the Romans are very definitely British, and you've got Laurence Olivier as Crassus.
That's right. Yes. Well, a lot of the people who wrote them had been people who had been witch hunted in the early 1950s by sort of McCarthyism. So a lot of them are written by people under assumed names and so on. And the theme of resistance to sort of totalitarianism, to oppression, which can obviously cut both ways, you know, is the totalitarian oppressor the United States or the Soviet Union? I mean, that's present in almost all these films, and indeed in the most recent iteration of the sort of Swords and Sandals.
Right.
Epic.
Very nicely set up.
Beautifully
set up, which I'm now going to spoil the setup, because just before we go into, I'm sure you can guess what film we're talking about, the most recent iteration. But this is from a book by George MacDonald Fraser, who wrote the Flashman novels about cinema and history. And he's talking about the Ben-Hur, Spartacus films. And he says, these were the days before the money ran out, the golden age in more ways than one. And and MacDonald Fraser is writing this, I think, in the 1980s. Unless some film laboratory genius comes up with a new process for recreating the Battle of Actium and the last days of Pompeii by computer, we shall not look upon their like again.
How wrong he was.
CGI. Well, no, he's right.
Yeah, well, because actually, you're right. Yeah. Well, he obviously thought that they wouldn't be able to do that.
But they did.
But they did, yeah.
So could we have our next one, please, Jack?
People should know when they're conquered.
Are you not entertained?
Very good.
So, Dominic, are you Gladiator fan?
I'm a huge Gladiator fan. When I saw that in Washington, D.C., when I was doing research for my history PhD. And there are probably some Americans with us tonight, I don't know. American audiences are much more voluble than British. And so at the end of it, people were shouting. I mean, they were genuinely very excited. And there were definitely moments in that film where I felt almost moved. I was moved. I had sort of a lump in my throat of joy, because I thought, if I had seen this film when I was about 11... I would have been sobbing wreck of delight.
I was obsessed by the Romans as a child, and so I would religiously, I use the word advisedly, watch, you know, every sword and sandal epic that came up, and they were a bit dull, but I'd watch it purely for the kind of spectacular moments, the moments when the legions came on or you had a kind of sweep of Rome, and then they stopped because obviously they were too expensive. So when I saw the opening 10 minutes of Gladiator, that battle,
yeah, fantastic.
The only time I've been happier in a cinema was watching the Brachiosaurs emerge in Jurassic Park. So those were the those were the two happiest times I spent, and I almost sobbed with delight. The thing that's great about it, I think, is that it's not actually, you know, it makes a virtue out of the fact that it's not particularly accurate. So you get kind of napalm in that battle, which is shot in a wood outside in Surrey.
Yeah,
it's just outside Guildford. And then when you come to see the shot of the Colosseum, it's obviously much, much larger.
Yes,
because the whole point is it's got to stun and awe, and the real Colosseum isn't big enough.
But what you have in that film is, I mean, first of all, that film is basically what a lot of people don't know about Gladiator is basically a remake of a film called The Fall of the Roman Empire,
which was the last one.
Yeah,
in that kind of sword and sandal epic.
With Christopher Plummer, I think, plays Commodus,
and Alec Guinness, I think, is Marcus Aurelius.
Marcus Aurelius, yes. So it's basically a remake of that, and it also has, it's very true to those 50s, 60s themes. So constantly and very anachronistically, there are people talking about restoring the Republic and
because if it had been, you know, 40 years earlier, it would be a Christian. There would be a Christian in that story.
Yes,
but,
I think that's
but
true.
That, you know, that's gone now, and so you need someone else, and so you need somebody who's fighting for democracy.
Yeah, well, that's the... So the scenes when...
Who is Derek Jacobi, who
is... Exactly. Yeah, so the scenes when Commodus, many of you will remember this, when Joaquin Phoenix is going into Rome for the first time as emperor. He's killed his father, he's going in. Those films are modelled on Leni Riefenstahl's Triumph of the Will. So the sort of the way the shot is constructed is very similar to that, as he rides in his chariot down the centre of a sort of avenue towards the waiting, towards the sort of the forum, the rostrum.
Which is entirely fitting because that sense of Nazi spectacle, I mean,
you know, fascism comes from Rome.
Is a Roman one.
Yeah.
Yes. So I think it all.
So we've done a lot of either Nazi or racist films so far. Anyway.
Okay, well, let's move on to another one, shall we?
Well,
okay.
Well, that's... Oh, Tom, I won't stand for that. That is shocking.
Okay.
Of all people. When you see what this film is, you'll see just how shocking Tom's remark is.
Well, I can't remember which one's coming first.
I think...
Oh, no, not that one, the other one. Okay, so what we're doing... What,
I think
can you put the one with the lightsabers on first, please, Jack? So what we're doing now is science fiction and fantasy, and how history has informed what may seem to be entirely made up.
You've gone out of order. You've gone out of order of the clips already.
Well,
shocking.
Dominic, that's the fun of live podcasting.
Yeah,
isn't it? It's chaos.
For over 1,000 generations, the Jedi Knights were the guardians of peace and justice in the Old Republic. Before the Dark Times. Before the Empire. Now the Jedi are all but extinct. Vader was seduced by the dark side of the Force.
So Marcus Aurelius there.
Yeah. Well, you see, this, I really wanted to do Star Wars for two reasons. I think one, because Star Wars... People don't appreciate it as much as they should as a historical artifact in its own right, so a product of 70s post-Vietnam America. So George Lucas deliberately trying to look back to his youth and to create as an antidote. I mean, if you read interviews with Lucas in the 70s, he says, you know, America's been torn apart by riots. We've got kind of Jimmy Carter as president. Everything's gone horribly wrong. I really wanted to do something that was innocent and that looked back to Flash Gordon.
Isn't the end modelled on... Triumph of the Will.
Well, yeah, exactly. So you've got another Triumph of the Will moment at the end, another Leni Riefenstahl moment when they walk up to get their medals. Chewbacca, of course, doesn't get a medal, which is the racism I assume that you're talking about.
Well, no, I was thinking the end of this supposedly innocent film is modelled on Hitler.
Yeah, but also, Tom, the Republic Empire stuff, which you see there. So this is, you could argue, this is the cinematic adaptation of a book called Rubicon by a well-known writer. So it's the fall.
You could.
It's the fall of. Did this not inspire Rubicon?
No.
Of course it did. You know it did. So it's the fall that they're talking about the Empire and the Republic. The Republic fell. There's a sense of decline, which is really unusual in films of that kind. It's one of the things that reviewers often commented on when Star Wars came out in 77. They said it's very unusual to see a film, a science fiction film, that has this sense of a kind of a lost past.
Yeah.
Which everything
well, it happens a lot in a galaxy far away, a long, long time ago.
A long time ago, exactly, yeah. So there's a sense of history built into Star Wars, but it's obviously very specifically, I think, Roman history.
Yeah, and that's about America, isn't it? Because the idea, you know, America is modeled on Rome, and notoriously the Roman Republic falls and becomes a monarchy, comes under the autocracy of the Caesars. So Darth Vader is a kind of Praetorian, is that what you're saying? Kind of Praetorian, captain of the Praetorians?
Yes, he is the sort of captain of the Praetorian Guard, isn't he? And the Emperor Palpatine, I mean, anybody who's seen the Star Wars prequels, which are obviously absolutely mind, but we were talking about them the other night, weren't we? About the Trade Federation and so on. And just how utterly abject those films are. But in that, so Palpatine is Octavian. He is the future Augustus. So he is a senator who goes on to amass more and more power on the basis of security and so on. And that's clearly, you know, informing that idea that we talked about in our very, very first podcast, I think, wasn't it? About the fear of Donald Trump becoming a dictator. That's kind of built into America's sense of itself as a republic.
Do you think also, I mean, again, we were talking about the British and American accents.
They did the same thing again, right, in Star Wars?
Yes, yeah, so there must also be a kind of a reverse riff on the American Revolution. It's
yeah. Well, I mean, the name, the Rebel Alliance, and then in the...
Yeah,
in
so, the so it's Peter film. Cushing, isn't it? It's the Grand Moff...
Grand Moff Tarkin.
The Grand Moff Tarkin. Well,
yes. Yeah.
That's the kind of dialogue that Han Solo...
Yeah, that Harrison Ford refused to say.
But they missed a chance, didn't they, not having Dave Prowse, who was from the West Country and the Green Cross Code man, who played Darth Vader... actually voicing his own. Because then it would have been much more clear.
The Force is with me. Die, Luke Skywalker.
Oh, my God. I didn't think you'd be doing a West Country accent on stage.
It just suddenly came to me. I just suddenly saw there was a chance. And
if we can find a way for you to do a Bullingdon Boys...
I'm sure they will at some point. They will at some point.
That's a popular one with the listeners. All right, let's have the next film, because I think we're too slow.
Okay.
This is Rachel Morley-style.
But this next one, I think, is actually the only one of all these films that we've watched together.
Yeah. Ooh.
So the Charge of the Rohirrim in Return of the King.
Well, we are going to see the film in which this is, that inspired this, aren't we, later on? And I think, so let's not spoil that.
Yeah,
so it's Return of the King, Tolkien. Go on, sorry, Tom.
So I think that this is probably the best film about late antiquity that's ever been made. So late antiquity, the period, that kind of the intersection point between the Roman period and the Middle Ages. And it's not a fashionable period at all for films to be made. There was one called Agora, about the philosopher Hypatia, but that's pretty much the only one I can think of.
There's no Justinian biopic.
No, there's no Justinian biopic. But essentially this derives from Tolkien, Lord of the Rings, which this is obviously based on. And he was a great scholar of this period. And the narrative of this siege of Minas Tirith, the great city, it's a kind of melange of all kinds of different episodes from late antique history, and indeed kind of further on as well. And so this cavalry charge, we've actually discussed it in one of the podcasts we did.
Is this where you did your rousing soliloquy?
It is. I did the rousing soliloquy, and we kind of laid some of the music over it.
Yeah, we did.
But the idea of pagan armies besieging shining Christian citadels. So one of the narratives is the Arab sieges of Constantinople. Another is the Hungarian siege of Augsburg, where a great band of cavalry led by a mighty warrior, Otto the Great, comes to the rescue. And essentially that's what this is doing. This is kind of drawing on the epic quality of all those ancient battles that most people, you know, it's not a particularly familiar period of history to people.
Yeah, and of course the whole Lord of the Rings project is inspired by, you know, the myths and legends of the North and so on, and Tolkien's own sense of history, his sense of a kind of a lost English folklore and all that stuff. But of course, it's also inspired by the history of the 20th century, so the World Wars, the Ring being...
And the films are pretty true to that, I think.
Yeah, I think they are too. I think they omit the final chapter of the Lord of the Rings, don't they? The scouring of the Shire, which Tolkien thought was integral to the story.
In that, the armour looks good. The idea that the riders of Rohan are Anglo-Saxons who've learnt to ride horses,
yes,
which was important to Tolkien. They're kind of true to that. I think also it opened with Eowyn looking terrified. And I think that's really good, the kind of sense of terror you must have felt before charging down a hill, or indeed going over the top. You know, that ties in with what you're saying about Tolkien having been in the trenches.
Which you don't see in the book, actually. I think they put that in. Eowyn is kind of haughty and cold in the book, but I don't think she's terrifying. I think that was a really nice touch. Some of Peter Jackson's touches, I think.
And apparently a wonderful contemporary touch is that there's the captain of the orcs who leading the attack on Minas Tirith was modelled on Harvey Weinstein.
Oh, that's right, of course, because Harvey Weinstein had fallen out with Peter Jackson in the kind of...
Yeah.
Yes, that's... Yes. He's called Gothmog. Is he the fellow with the kind of terrible face?
Yes, and it's modelled on Harvey Weinstein.
Very good.
So there's a little bit of something there for everyone. Okay, I think we've done that, have we? Should we...
I think
Rachel
we have,
Morley
I think,
on?
I think we should omit... why don't you do your French film now? And we'll omit my next one.
So the next categories are films...
Well, we're only going to do one of them, Tom.
Oh, are we? Okay.
We're going too slowly.
Okay. It's a French film called Ridicule. What we want to talk about here is films where the motor of the plot is true to the customs, to the perspective of a distinct historical period, rather than kind of anachronistically exporting our own assumptions and attitudes back. And I think that this is one of the great, great historical films for that reason.
C'est lui, c'est Dieu, qu'on a souri sa propre cause. J'ai démontré ce soir l'existence de Dieu. Mais je pourrais tout aussi bien démontrer le contraire quand il plaira à sa majesté.
Tu finiras à la Bastille, j'y veillerai, philosophe.
Majesté, ça n'était qu'un trait d'esprit.
Have you seen this?
No, so tell me about this, Tom.
Okay.
You've told me about it and I've just refused to watch it. So,
okay, fair
persuade
enough.
Me.
Fair enough.
Persuade me of its importance.
So the king there is Louis XVI. He's at Versailles. This is just before the revolution. And the plot revolves around a very minor nobleman from the south of France where malaria is rife. He's an engineer. He wants funds from Versailles to drain the swamps so that the local peasants around his chateau will stop dying of malaria. And so he goes to Versailles to try and see the king. But he gets there and he discovers that the best way to have an audience with the king is to put on displays of wit. And it turns out that he's naturally...
So this podcast could...
Absolutely, yeah. He's naturally a very witty person. He's very, very good at it. And so it's kind of like duels of wit. And the guy we saw there, he's an abbé. He also is trying to get to the king, and that's his huge chance. And so he delivers this sermon proving the existence of God, and then fatefully he over-relies on wit and says, well, I could also prove that God doesn't exist. And that's a terrible no-no.
And so what you think is great about this is that it gets into the heads of the 18th century in a non-sort of 20th century. It's 1996, isn't it? So, because that's the other film we were going to show, but we don't really have time to go into it in a big way, so let's just skip it, is Master and Commander. And the relationship between Aubrey...
Oh, go on, let's have it. Let's have it.
Are you
sure? Go on, yeah, let's have it. Just very quickly.
Excuse me, sir, but Mr. Blakeney said that you served under Lord Nelson.
His zeal for king and country kept him warm. I know it sounds absurd, and were it from another man, you'd cry out, oh, what pitiful stuff, and dismiss it as mere enthusiasm. But with Nelson, you felt your heart glow.
So that's a scene where they're talking about Nelson, obviously, and they're all enthused, except for one person who we don't really see in that clip, who is Stephen Maturin, who is the Paul Bettany character.
Oh, yes, this is from your interminable novels about rope.
Yeah, don't you say you like this film, so don't.
Yeah, I do.
So, yes, it's from the Patrick O'Brien Master and Commander novels, and as those of you who like the novels will know, the essence of the novels is this sort of dualism between Aubrey and Maturin. Aubrey is a sort of Tory, red-faced, kind of long blonde hair, stick it to the French, kind of Hogarthian character.
So Russell Crowe.
He's Russell Crowe. And Maturin is, he's half Irish, half Catalan. He is much more sceptical, witty. He's sort of doubting. There's an element of him...
Paul Bettany.
Yeah, he's Paul Bettany. And there's an element of him in the books and the film being the sort of Uhtred character in Bernard Cornwell's books, i.e. the secular, sceptical sort of voice of the 20th, 21st century reader. It works with Master and Commander, I think, because that was a kind of hinge moment, the late 18th, early 19th century, when there were people like Maturin. So that kind of... He works in a way that... Uhtred, or let's say the Shard Lake, is it character in the C.J. Sanson Tudor books?
Or all those kind of Christian slaves in Epic.
Yeah, you know. Who say, why can't you be democratic? Yes. You know, that kind of...
One day we will have a brotherhood of man. Yes. All that kind of stuff.
So I think Master and Commander does get into the heads of 18th century people in a way that a lot of films don't, because I think there was a genuine debate in the late 18th century. But I think it's obviously almost all these historical films that we're talking about are... seen very much through the prism of modernity, aren't they?
Yes, yeah, they are. But I think the ridicule more than most does get away from that, and it works brilliantly because, of course, Versailles is a kind of enclosed space, and it has its own rules, and all the characters in the film are basically trapped in it. And it's kind of a science fiction thing where you're trapped in a bit like Squid Game, actually, where you're in an enclosed place. You're not entirely sure what the rules are. It's incredibly competitive. You have to get elbow people aside to reach your destination. But it's just really, really brilliantly done. And I think that French cinema is really, really good with history. I think that it has a much kind of...
I completely agree with you, Tom.
We've got a much subtler understanding of it.
We've got another French film coming up. But okay, let's go outside. Yeah, let's go further outside the Anglo-American film tradition for our next... So our next category are... So these are films... Obviously, you know, if you think of cinema as the 20th century medium, it's also very much a Cold War medium. And so these are two films coming up. We'll do the clips one at a time. In which the politics of the Cold War weighs on the film. So here's our first Cold War film. So I say Cold War, but actually this is it's a film about communism, obviously.
Is it, though?
Well, it is, because it's about the people, isn't it? And the Russian people are the hero, just as Alexander Nevsky. So this is Alexander Nevsky, the film.
A prince.
1938, Sergei Eisenstein's first film for 10 years. It's got an amazing, fascinating backstory. So Alexander Nevsky is, what, 13th century Prince of Novgorod? Yeah. Who is recalled from exile or comes back from exile, I can't remember what.
He's been hanging out with the Mongols, hasn't he?
He has. He's been associated with the Mongols, never a very good idea. And he's called back and he leads the defence of Russia, of Novgorod, against the Teutonic Knights. So it comes out in 1938 and it's very much a film made with an eye to the international situation. So the Teutonic Knights, you know, they are crusaders, obviously. There's a very Ku Klux Klan element to them there.
And I was wondering, presumably Eisenstein is influenced by Griffith.
Yeah, I'm sure he is, because Eisenstein had been to Hollywood in that intervening 10-year period.
So they're very much the villains.
Very much the villains. The bishop who is... So Christianity there is the...
It's Rome. It's evil.
It's evil, exactly.
Yes. I watched it, and... I thought that it's a nationalist film rather than a communist film.
It is,
and it's the kind of thing that you know, at the moment, what's going on in Belarus and Ukraine, you could absolutely imagine Putin putting this on to whip up.
You could. I think there is an interesting blend there of nationalism and communism, as in the Russian people are the heroes.
But presumably Prince Nevsky is Stalin? Is that too reductive?
Well, yes. Or? So Eisenstein, while he was making the film, he writes an article. Just checking my notes. Eisenstein wrote an article saying that Alexander Nevsky was like Stalin. So, in other words, Stalin is a great man, but he's also the expression of the popular will. And that's true of Alexander Nevsky, too. And, of course, that scene, it's called The Battle on the Ice. It's the one scene, actually, of all the clips that we're showing where I really wished that we could show the whole thing, because it's about an 8-minute charge.
And it's so influential. So the Tolkien and right. every and Gladiator, I mean, all of those battles are
based on that.
Riff
yeah.
on that, yeah.
And it's got a Prokofiev soundtrack written especially for the film, incredibly pounding soundtrack. I mean, you can see the clip on YouTube, and it really is, it's hypnotic, actually, that one scene. But what's so fascinating about it, the history, is that it comes out in the end of 1938, it's a tremendous hit. Supposedly 23 million Russians watched it. And then, of course, in August 1939...
yes, they have to suddenly change.
Yeah.
Oh, actually.
They signed the Germans are all right. Backed, yeah. So the film is suppressed. It's dropped from cinemas. They no longer show it.
Until 1941?
Until 1941, when Hitler invades. And then suddenly the film miraculously reappears in the cinemas. So that's a... I mean, Eisenstein was
And what happens in 1941... In kind of propaganda terms, is that communist propaganda goes very nationalist.
It does
it?
Exactly. So embracing icons, embracing Russian Orthodoxy, and then interestingly, as a sort of coda to this, Eisenstein is commissioned to make a film about Ivan the Terrible, who is Stalin's historical hero. So he makes two films, and Stalin doesn't like film number two, and so the trilogy is abandoned, and Eisenstein is living in utter terror of being basically shot because he's made a film that's too critical of Ivan the Terrible and doesn't show him. You know, Stalin summons him to the Kremlin. There's an amazing transcript of Stalin just berating him about his supposed historical errors. And Stalin says to him, I've read a lot of history, I know a lot about history, and just gives him a terrible time. So so that's one film. Now, we should do another film, which is, it appears to be a film about one thing, and it's actually a film about something else. So should we have the next clip?
Okay, so this could be a kind of sequel to Reticule, couldn't it? Because this is set in the French Revolution.
Exactly.
Mais qu'est-ce qui se passe encore avec le pain? Il paraît que c'est la guerre.
La guerre, ça explique pas tout. Le manque de pain, c'est provoqué.
Provoqué par qui?
Par ceux qui veulent discréditer le gouvernement. Ils affament les gens pour les pousser à la révolte.
Ou alors c'est le gouvernement lui-même.
Pourquoi faire?
Donner le pouvoir à quelqu'un et ça le pourrit.
Regardez! Regardez!
C'est Gérard Depardieu.
It was indeed Gérard Depardieu. Very different man in those days from
not
today, where he's being dragged off planes, isn't he, often having wet himself on the plane from drinking too much and
yes.
so on. Something that I'm sure never happens to you, Tom.
Never.
so this is... I was shown this at school. Our history teacher...
So it's 1983.
Yeah.
Polish film director?
Yes, Andrzej Wajda. Whose previous film had been about solidarity, which gives you a kind of clue to the subtext behind the film. Because basically, he'd done a film about solidarity with...
the Polish trade union.
Yeah, with Lech Walesa making a cameo appearance in the film. And Andrzej Wajda, his father had been one of the Polish officers killed by the Russians in the Katyn massacre.
Right.
In the Second World War. So he's not a great admirer of either the Soviet Union or indeed of communism.
Yeah.
So he's originally going to make this film about Danton and the French Revolution, about how the revolution consumes Danton, the sort of Robespierre-Danton feud.
So, Danton is kind of Keir Starmer, and Robespierre is Jeremy Corbyn. I mean, very, very, very loosely.
So, can you imagine Gérard Depardieu playing Keir Starmer?
No. Well, it would be his greatest role yet.
Yeah. So, he's going to make this film in Poland. The Polish government, he's very much persona non grata after the sort of martial law imposed in Poland in, I think, 1981, the General Jaruzelski's regime. So he decides he's going to make it in France, and he brings over some of his Polish crew and cast. But then he took Depardieu to Warsaw when they were making the film, and they had a day where Depardieu met Solidarity leaders and so on to kind of inspire him. And obviously, this is a film about... It's an anti-communist film. It's an anti-revolutionary film. And, you see that scene there, the bread queues, the paranoia, the government informers and spies and so on. And when it came out, it was denounced by a lot of French historians of the revolution.
And including Mitterrand, François Mitterrand, and Jacques Lang, who was the culture minister.
Because they'd put up money for it.
Ready for the bicentennial of the revolution in 89. So they were expecting something that would kind of glamorise it and celebrate it.
Yeah, and they were gutted. Absolutely gutted.
And also, is it true? It must be, because I read it on Wikipedia. I'm not going to lie.
Tom does his research. He really does.
that Danton and his followers are French, and Robespierre and his followers are Polish.
I think it's generally true. Yeah, I think
so. There's a kind of English American accent thing going on there.
I mean, it's a very kind of Burkean view of the revolution, Thomas Carlyle or something, as the revolution as this demonic monster. And in the trial scene, Depardieu is brilliant, by the way. He's a joke, admittedly, now. But when you see this film, you see what a brilliant actor he was, because he's utterly riveting. And he has these huge speeches about how the revolution is out of control, it's devouring its children, all this sort of stuff, which went down very badly with some French historians who said, you know, you're really maligning Robespierre. The revolution was under attack from abroad, and you're missing out, all this kind of thing.
Pitt.
Yes, yes. There are anti-Pittites.
Yes.
It's a film that appears to be about the French Revolution, but actually it's a very good example of all discussions of the French Revolution, or indeed all history, tend to come back to the present.
Which brings us to our next category, which is portrayals of very, very alien, distant ways of seeing the world that don't try to kind of extenuate them or whitewash them, principally because the people making the films kind of rather identify with the values of the very alien, strange and remote peoples that they are filming. So could we have the Spartan one first?
At age 7, as is customary in Sparta, the boy was taken from his mother and plunged into a world of violence. By rod and lash, the boy was punished. Taught to show no pain, no mercy. For he would return to his people a Spartan. Or not at all.
So that's 300 about the Battle of Thermopylae, in which the Spartans go and fight in tight black speedos and nothing else. and we've talked about this before.
It's a Restless history favourite.
It is. But the salient thing about this is that the Spartans were a kind of great inspiration for the fascists, for the Nazis, and this is basically a fascist film, it seems to me.
Well, Frank Miller, the guy who writes the comic book that it's based on, is kind of definitely on the right of American politics. So he wrote a lot of very aggressive.
He's a Black Knight, wasn't he? Didn't he do the Batman?
Batman the Dark Knight. Batman in the 1980s as the
kind
as
of
a much
vigilante.
Harder, the vigilante, yeah. Exactly. From the Adam West, because you'd had the Adam West sort of Batman, pow, biff.
Holy shark repellent Batman.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So he was the guy who reinvented him as a slightly dirty Harry-ish kind of figure. And then I think Frank Miller sort of got himself cancelled by a lot of comic book enthusiasts after 9/11 by doing comics that they saw as Islamophobic. But there's definitely this edge, isn't there? So this is a film also about the present, because he thinks these are the values that America is losing.
Yes, but for instance, there is no equivalent of the Christian or the senator who wants to reintroduce democracy or anything like that. This is absolutely upfront. It's brilliant to take away your children and, you know, beat them up so that they then become better soldiers. And the film opens with the scene where the babies who haven't measured up to the standards of Spartan eugenics have been chucked down a cliff, and you see all the kind of the little bones and skulls, and this is presented, you know, absolutely baldly as being a brilliant thing, which is kind of really shocking, which is why actually I think 300 is one of the best films about the ancient world ever made, because it doesn't try and palliate just how strange and unsettling and alien it is. And of course you mentioned the Islamophobia of Frank Miller, but this was made against the backdrop of really, really heightened US-Iranian hostility.
Yeah.
And that the Persian king in this is portrayed as a kind of 13-foot drag queen.
Yes.
And loads of Iranians were kind of saying, you know, they weren't like that, which is indisputably true. He wasn't.
Yeah. But this is obviously the Greek...
This is the Greek
image of the Persians.
Yes, both terrifying and effeminate, because they wore trousers.
But it's interesting how that has lingered as so controversial, because when we did our podcast, I think about... I can't remember if there's a podcast about Persia or about Thermopylae, and those of you who are on Twitter will know that we advertise them, and we pick photos one of us has a very good photo game and the other maybe not so good. And one of my...
One of us is very much BBC Two. One of us is very, very much Dave.
Well...
And I'm...
Yeah. You know. Fine, you can be BBC Two, Mr. Open University. Okay, so...
But
Dominic, so I used a photo of Xerxes from this film,
and then
my sort of Twitter timeline was
exploded with
angry Persians.
Yes, well, yes, yeah, because of course Persia does not get a look in, and so the question then is, well, what would a Persian at the court of Xerxes, what kind of film would they have made? And I think the answer can be found actually not in a film made by an Iranian director, but by a Chinese director. So could we have the next clip?
That's a very nice link. Well done.
That's Hero. It's an amazing film. Those of you who've seen 300 will remember that there's the great shower of arrows, and the joke is that we'll be able to fight in the shade with all these arrows. Here we're seeing from the perspective of the emperor who has launched a kind of arrow storm, and that emperor is Qin Shi Huangdi, who will become the first emperor of United China, the founder of
so this
of
is set when?
Empire.
What century are we in?
So this is set, that's a good question, 3rd century, I think.
Right.
It's completely enthusiastic about the establishment of a kind of imperial autocracy, because the plot basically is a series of assassins who have been employed to assassinate the king of Qin, who we saw ordering the arrow flight. And the twist turns out at the end that... actually, they mustn't assassinate him because he's going to unite China and enable the Chinese Empire to emerge. So you could absolutely imagine, you know, the Persian equivalent of that being screened at Persepolis and going down very well with Darius.
But there's
Xerxes.
A whole load of films, aren't there, Tom, that we are not particularly aware of in the West, which are often commissioned and paid for by, for example, the Russian government or the Chinese government or indeed the Iranian government. So Saddam Hussein used to commission films about history.
Yes. You know? he wrote historical novels, didn't
he? Yes, he did. So that sort of sense of using historical films as a kind of, as a sort of bulwark of your regime or a personality cult or an idea of
I think these are exceptionally good. I mean, that is an exceptionally beautiful film. You've got a sense of that with that arrow storm. Yeah. The whole way, I mean, it is stunningly beautiful. But
you don't feel at all queasy watching it, is my question.
Well, no, by the end, I'm so kind of enthused. I'm going, hooray for China. Let's conquer everything. It's a very, very powerful work of propaganda that completely persuaded me.
Well, I mean, that's...
And so I think a kind of pairing of 300 and Hero would be... It would give you a very good sense of...
And here's a question. Do you think that cinema has a sort of unique or unparalleled propagandistic power? Because obviously there have always been, you know, Shakespeare's plays were propaganda for the regime. But do you think cinema is more insidious, is more powerful?
I think it's insidious where it's pretending not to be propaganda.
Well, we've got...
Don't you? Okay, and
shame.
Doesn't that beautifully lead us into our next, which is film as propaganda?
Is which one? Yes, so now we've got...
I think we should go for there's one that's good that it's not really propaganda. And there's one that's so bad that it's nothing but propaganda.
Yeah, but both very effective. So
both incredibly effective.
Which should we do first?
Let's do the good one.
Okay, let's do the first film of the propaganda films. So this is I mean, this is an absolutely brilliant film. If you haven't seen it, I cannot recommend it too highly. It's a film called The Battle of Algiers from 1966. So it was made just a few... It's a very rare example of a historical film made in the right location using a lot of the same participants just a few years after the events that it's describing. So it's set in the mid-1950s, at the beginning of the sort of French war in Algeria. It's set in the Casbah, in the old city, where the French are trying to suppress a nationalist uprising. And what's also really interesting about this film compared with a lot of the ones going from Mr. Lincoln onwards is so many historical films are about a protagonist, a great man, aren't they? I mean, Hero, perfect example. In this, there is no single protagonist. The heroes, to, in a sense, of the Algerian people. It's a rare film, I think, that actually really puts the people at centre stage.
It's an incredible film. And the reason that it's so brilliant as propaganda is that it's actually incredibly fair. So it shows that the FLN, the Algerian resistance movement, are perfectly as capable of atrocities as the Pieds Noirs, the French... Yeah, in Algeria,
I mean, there's a
who
scene
are fighting
where they,
back.
They blow up. That they show a series of terrorist atrocities, don't they?
Yeah.
Including blowing up a bar, milk bar, which is a real story, really happened. I mean, you wouldn't see something like that now, I think.
No,
it'd be inconceivable that somebody within 10 years of a bomb attack would make a film, not quite glorifying the perpetrators, but neither condemning nor glorifying, I suppose.
And all the actors in it are they're not. They're not professional actors, are they?
No.
Apart from one who's the kind of he's the head of the French paratroopers who comes in and wins the Battle of Algiers. He launches this counterinsurgency,
through torture partly.
Absolutely through torture. He blows entire homes up when people don't surrender. I mean, it's kind of very brutal. But he's a very charismatic man.
Yeah.
He's a cultivated, elegant man.
He's the film's. It seems an extraordinary thing to say, given what he's doing is barbaric, but he's in some ways the film's most admirable, identifiable character, isn't he? He's the only one that's played by a professional actor. So the character is based on a real person called Jacques Massu, paratroop commander. The actor playing him had been a paratrooper himself, had been in the French resistance, had fought in Indochina, which was true. Is true of the character too. And what's great about it is part, as you say, the even-handedness. And what's so fascinating is that when the Americans went into, I think, Iraq, they had screenings of this film.
Yeah.
Which is odd, because the French obviously lose in Algeria.
Yeah.
But the Americans
But
in
this film, they do win, don't they? I mean, that's the thing.
Yeah, well, except there's a coda, isn't it, when the crowd are swelling through the streets and all sort of...
Yes. So it's Edward Said's favourite film.
It was
very popular with the Baader-Meinhof group.
Yeah, it was Andreas Baader's favourite film. Because it's anti-Western, anti-colonial, I suppose.
But also apparently it's not. It wasn't only the American military in Iraq who looked at it. Apparently it was also the Argentine military.
Yeah. And a lot of that is because it's done in this neorealist style. So a lot of it sometimes feels like a documentary, or it feels like newsreel. And there are bits with voiceovers, and there are bits with all kinds of kind of documentary techniques.
I mean, I think it leaves you in no doubt that you're on the side of the Algerians. You're meant to be on the side of the Algerians in the film, but it works so powerfully, precisely because it can be shown to Argentine secret policemen and so on.
Is that your test of a good film?
Well, I think a test of balance would be whether it appeals to both sides, I guess.
Well, I think of all the films we've done so far, it probably is the most ideologically sophisticated.
Yeah, it's a brilliant film. It's very, very ideologically sophisticated. Can we have our next film, please?
I'm dying in your bed many years from now. Would you be willing to trade all the days from this day to that for one chance? Just one chance to come back here and tell our enemies that they may take our lives, but they'll never take our freedom!
I find it so hard to watch, though.
So that's Braveheart, which John O'Farrell wittily said that the only way it could have been more inaccurate as if it had featured a plasticine dog and been called William Wallace and Gromit.
Well, there was a great... I did some reading about Braveheart on the way down today, and an American academic who writes about medieval Scotland called... What's her name? Sharon Crosser. She wrote about it, and she said... to give you a sense of the costumes, she said, it's rather like somebody making a film about colonial America, in which they're all wearing 20th century business suits the wrong way round.
Yeah, okay, so he's wearing the woad of a Pict, basically.
Yeah, he's wearing the woad.
And he's wearing a tartan, which kind of is 18th century. So,
right, exactly.
Yeah, it's spectacular. It's both future and past.
But an incredibly effective film.
It's a really good film.
Do you not think? I mean,
yes. I mean, it really tugs the heartstrings and makes you think, yeah, let's go independent. Oh, I'm English.
Am I not right in thinking that at the very beginning, Edward Longshanks is described as a pagan? Is that not right? They say a pagan army is attacking Scotland. They sort of throw everything at it.
The plot revolves around him having the right to sleep with a droit de seigneur.
There is a droit de seigneur, yes.
And he was famously uxorious. He famously, Ellen of Castile, got the... Yeah. The Eleanor Cross at Charing Cross, not far from here.
An Irish historian said of it that he said that the indication of the accuracy of Braveheart was that the Battle of Stirling Bridge, they forgot to have a bridge.
Well, also, the Braveheart is Robert Bruce. Yeah. Because they take his heart, don't they, and chuck it at the Saracens in a battle. And I think Isabella of France, who... The she-wolf for France. She is shown having an affair with William Wallace.
That's right.
And
she's Sophie Marceau, isn't she? Yeah.
She was three at the time, historically.
But Tom, this raises that classic thing that people talk about accuracy. So, you know, I'm sure we've both been asked this a thousand times. Does it matter? Is it important for historical films to be accurate? What do you think?
Well, as someone who doesn't want Scotland to go independent, yeah, I think it does matter because I think it did have a kind of measurable effect on turbocharging the campaign for Scottish independence, and I think that it, you know, it's just a farrago of lies and falsehoods.
It is, but
it's a brilliant film.
Yeah, and exactly, I think that's the key thing with films.
But then you can say the same of a number of other.
If you're making a film about anything, all that matters is to make a good film. I personally don't think historical accuracy matters in films.
Well, yeah, except look at our first film. I mean...
What was that? It seems so long ago. Yes, I mean, that's a historically inaccurate film and it has a toxic effect, but it doesn't mean that all historically inaccurate films have toxic effects.
No, which leads us on to our next category, which is deconstructing history.
All right, so we're getting into Tom's section of the...
talking of inaccurate history, could we have the one go, whoa?
Und hence, his aggression, transference... On to Ted.
Whoa!
Okay, Ted.
Yes. Thank you very much, Sigmund Freud.
Okay. So, you haven't seen Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
I've spoken about it on television, but I've never seen it. I've never seen it fully. I always think too much knowledge can be a bit of a handicap when you're analysing things.
Okay, so I'll tell you the plot. So the next time you get asked to talk about it on television, you can really be... So Bill and Ted are kind of slackers in 1990s California. They have to fulfil a history project or else the world will be blown up. It's complicated, don't ask. And so they get taken back in time and they bring back various luminaries from history and two medieval babes back to California... And they win their history project, and I loved the film. I've seen it several times. I thought it was very funny, very sweet, but I also think it's unbelievably pernicious.
Well, here's a weird thing. So on the train today, I thought I'd better read up about Bill and Ted because I know Tom has chosen it. So like, I went to the Wikipedia entry for Bill and Ted, and there's a thing that says historical reception or themes or something, and it just quotes you.
Does it? What?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
What did I say?
British historian Tom Holland writing in the London Observer. You've obviously written an essay about Bill and Ted.
I've completely forgotten about that.
Wow.
What did I say?
It was just stuff about Christian
cricket. I'm sure it wasn't. But the reason why this is pernicious is that, or let's say very, very, at least as nationalist as Braveheart, is that it offers up 1990s California as the absolute be-all and end-all. This is the kind of end point of historical...
Wow, Francis Fukuyama.
And so basically, all these kind of Socrates, or Socrates, as he's called, Napoleon, Joan of Arc, and so on, are brought back, and they all go around and say, whoa, this is amazing, this is great. And we're talking about how effective and powerful, say, the French treatment of history is. So Joan of Arc and Napoleon are both time-tested subjects of French films. Napoleon, you know, the subject of one of the great early films. I think Joan of Arc's been... possibly more films have been made about Joan of Arc than any other.
Can that be true?
Yeah, I think they've made loads and loads of films about her. But here... the Americans take over these icons of French history and cinema, bring them back, and they discover how brilliant it is to be American.
Right, well, there's obviously a metaphor there, isn't there? Now, you have another film you want to do.
I do. So this is...
I think you were really queuing up the other film, weren't you?
Yeah, so can we have an excerpt? Remember, this is Deconstructing History.
Okay, so that's Monty Python and the Holy Grail, isn't it? 1975. So I'm curious to see what you're going to say. That will... you can't get the sacral into this, surely?
No. Well I...
except for the Grail.
So that's King Arthur and his knights charging down a hill, attacking a castle. And we've had an awful lot of knights kind of charging down hills, attacking things. And maybe they'd all be improved by having the police turn up and arrest, you know, arrest William Wallace or...
So I've never really liked this because I like King Arthur too much. So I don't like anything irreverent about King Arthur. Have I told my King Arthur, the Spaceman and King Arthur anecdote before on the podcast? So the very first time I was taken to the cinema by my parents when I was about four, we went to the Majestic Theatre in Bridge North in Shropshire to see The Spaceman and King Arthur, a Disney live action film based on Mark Twain's A Connecticut Yankee at the court of King Arthur. So a spaceman goes out of control and he travels back in time because he's gone into orbit in a weird way. And he lands at King Arthur's court. And King Arthur and his knights are all played by Carry-On Stalwarts. So we went to see this film with my friend Ian, who lived just down the road. Very exciting moment, first film. And I was utterly unprepared for the levity of a film about King Arthur. And so after about 10, 20 minutes... I can still remember doing it. I started shouting at the other people in the audience, telling them to stop laughing.
and so your career as a Daily Mail columnist is boring. This is outrageous. Attack on our history.
Exactly, exactly. A top historian speaks out. I had to be taken out of the cinema.
Okay. So the reason... there are actually... I mean, you know, there are an awful lot of films about history that are comedies. And I think that what that shows is that the boundary between a film working and a film being kind of risible is actually quite narrow. And it tends to revolve around money. So the whole thing in Monty Python is they can't afford, you know, they can't afford a horse, so the peasant follows with the coconuts kind of clopping. And in that one, they finally get, you know, have enough extras to do a charge, and they all get arrested by the police. And the woman who has kind of encouraged them to do the arrest is the wife of a historian who's popped up in the middle of the film and is doing a piece to camera when he gets killed by, I think, King Arthur or something like that.
That's right.
So it's...
But it's a very fine line, though, because I noticed when we did Braveheart, everybody laughed. I mean, they did. Lots of people in the audience laughed.
Except for the Scottish.
But when the film came out in the 1990s, I mean, nobody laughed at it then. Historians complained that it was inaccurate. But that line is so sort of porous between being rousing. I mean, no one laughs at the charge and the return of the king.
No.
But why do we laugh at Braveheart? We laugh because Mel Gibson has subsequently tarnished himself, and because it's become a bit of a cliche, hasn't it? The sort of the Scottish flag on his...
And I suppose the other Monty Python film that we could have included would be The Life of Brian, which is again a kind of riff on all the cliches of the biblical epics.
Yeah.
And again, kind of just how easy it is for these themes to kind of tipple over into to bathos or just well, look a bit cheap or
talking of which we have yes. a very pathetic
okay so this is our last this is our last segment and this is the theme of mythology.
Tom, I just want to say Tom chose both these films, so don't hold me responsible at all. They're a terrifying glimpse into Tom's subconscious.
The last one, if you're running sweepstakes on what films are going to turn up, if any of you get the last one in this, I'll be impressed. Anyway, can we have the first one, please?
So you see, that's very Braveheart-like, isn't it? Because he's a slight, a bit of a titter when Brad Pitt appears on screen.
Yeah, so that's Troy. And the reason I wanted to include myth is because, you know, we've just been talking about King Arthur. That's Troy, a Greek myth. There are quite a lot of films where a little seasoning of myth, a little touch of myth kind of dignifies it, gives
Clash
it an extra
Titans.
Kind of... Yeah, or Jason and the Argonauts, which we also had. But Troy, I think, is the worst film about a myth ever made. In fact, I think it's the worst historical film ever made.
Wow, that is a big claim.
It's so terrible. It takes everything so clunkingly literal. So the thing everyone knows about Helen of Troy, she's the face that launched 1,000 ships. It's poetry. Oh, let's have 1,000, literally 1,000 yeah. ships. I bet if you counted those ships, there would be 1,000.
But it doesn't have... So it's the Iliad...
But without the gods.
With no gods.
Yeah. So they're trying to make a myth that's a myth.
Yeah.
A history.
But I suppose their argument there is that if you put the gods on screen, it's very hard to do that without it being kind of,
well,
it is in
problem,
Clash of the Titans,
it?
Risible.
That's yeah. their problem.
Well, okay, I mean...
It makes me so cross. And do you know what, Dominic? There's an absolutely brilliant example of how you can include the mythic... the strange, the weird, a sense of the supernatural.
I know what's coming. I know the film that you've
you
chosen.
You can absolutely weave it in, and it completely enhances the effect, and it's so powerful, and you don't even notice what's going on. Can we have the next clip, please? The last clip.
By the words I try to find my love, my life, but I know I don't possess you. With all my heart, God bless you. You are still my lover, my love. Yes, I know I don't possess you. With all my heart, God bless you. You are still my love.
Oh. So come on, Tom, explain.
Oh. Mamma Mia 2, I think, is the best film that's been made this century.
Wow.
So Dominic, I know you haven't seen either of them.
No.
Okay. So Mamma Mia is a romp. It's fun. It's great. And at the end of it, you get Benny and Bjorn from ABBA, and they're playing Greek gods up on clouds. And the whole thing is, of course, it's set in Greece, so there's a Greek god element.
I just want to make sure everyone remembers who chose the Battle of Algiers, and who chose Mamma Mia too,
and who chose Birth of a Nation. Mamma Mia two. Meryl Streep, who you saw in the dungarees retreating, has died, and it's on two time levels. You've got Meryl Streep's daughter, who is she's still around, and then you've got the young Meryl Streep, who's coming to the island, and this is the moment where the daughter's baby is being baptized, and suddenly, unexpectedly, Meryl Streep reappears.
So moving.
And she comes in, and she's come from the underworld. And this is, you know, you're in Greece, and so suddenly this idea that the dead can come back.
So powerful.
But they can't... Dominic, show some respect. Show some respect. And what is the great story where someone is being brought up from the dead, they're almost embracing and then slip away? It's Orpheus and Eurydice. And there's an element there. And then right in the end, you get Meryl Streep again dancing with Pierce Brosnan, who's her husband, who you should, you know, James Bond. And
right.
And this time they embrace.
Oh.
And honestly, there's not a dry eye in the house. Now, obviously, it's very difficult for me to convey this when I've got the voice of Middle England grumping away in the corner. But honestly, I started watching Mamma Mia 2. I started crying about 10 minutes in, came out absolutely red-eyed, and there was this woman who'd gone with her children, and we just sobbed on each other's shoulders.
Every time
I see the end of that film, I sob.
Oh, Tom, that's very moving.
And the thing is that the myth is not obvious. You could completely miss it, but it's a little it's a little touch of seasoning.
They definitely believe you. They definitely believe you.
Of course they do. It's a little touch of seasoning that's so delicate you don't even realise it's there until I point it out.
Okay, very good. So I think that's our last film, isn't it? Talk about a pathetic ending.
We've ended with the best film of the
of the century.
Yeah.
So what we've also done is we've very cleverly gone just enough time over agreed speaking time to not be ejected by security guards. But also, I'm not sure we've actually left any time for questions, have we? So if we're lurking about at the end of the show, which we undoubtedly will be, and you want to come up and ask us some questions or just come up and talk to Tom about Christianity. This will be your moment if you can locate him. But I think we're pretty much done. Am I right?
I think so. So thanks very, very much. Thank you for coming.
Thank you very much.